When did you want this summary? Not now, presumably. You want to ask questions?
Would you guys be happy to give a summary after tea then? Can you do it now?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to talk for myself. Yeah.
Can you do it now, Trevor, without any preparation plan?
Well, I can. I would help out.
Yeah, great. I'm sure you'll do it very well.
I think I painted a rather simplistic picture of the historical situation, but I think it is fair to say that at the end of the Enlightenment, there was this very confident view that science, we didn't know what scientific method was or what science was and how it differed from non-science, but we jolly well soon would, and that it would all become very simple, and that we would understand why it was such a successful method. And the story, as I try to portray, is it has been a decline from that position of optimism. Now, the Popper Kuhn debate that we've heard, that's really about, I think, about scientific method, mainly. Do you agree with that? It's mainly about scientific method, because Popper thought, he was really old-fashioned in the sense that he thought there was the method of science, and that once we'd defined it in a very clear way, we would be able to distinguish science from non-science and understand why science was so successful. It isn't clear that where he would have stood on things like realism and essentialism. I'm not sure quite what he would have said, because his theory really excludes the idea that we'll ever reach truth. We'll know very clearly what isn't true. That's what falsification tells you. It tells you that theories aren't true. It doesn't tell you which ones are. And therefore, no theory is going to describe the world for certain. And its ontology, the ontology of the various theories, can't be known to be true. They can only be known not to be true. And so that debate about a method really falls apart once Kuhn and others have attacked Popper. There doesn't seem to be a method. So we're not going to be able to identify science by its method. That's the claim. Now, that leaves us to try to say, well, what status do scientific theories have? Are they simply a predictive devices? Now, one of the problems with instrumentalism, which we heard defended, is that it seems not to offer research programs. After all, if you have a theory that there are bacteria, and that's what causes illness in cattle or in human beings, then you can now have a research program which encourages you to look for bacteria. And when you found them, you start looking for the different kinds of bacteria and their properties and what will attack them and what won't. When you suddenly find that there are some diseases which don't seem to be caused by bacteria, you then start looking for viruses. You have a theory which proposes viruses, you can start looking for those. In other words, realism, a realistic approach to science, suggests a program of research. Now, the question then is, what's the status of these objects we're looking for? Are they just predictive devices? Are they just words within theories to predict results? And the realist says, no, they're not. And the essentialist most clearly does. I suppose you didn't mention Harre and so on, who talked about causal powers.
Well, the causal powers is in truth,
you know, yes. Harre, that's what we don't know. But the idea that... Sorry?
I'm ready.
But you have the idea that matter must, by its very nature, explain the causal connections that Hume said we should notice. Now, let's see how important this is in research, for example, in genetics. People say there's a gay gene or a gene for criminality and so on. Now, all you can do, if you're a Humean, is to show that people with, say, who are homosexual will have certain sort of complex of genes. But you've not shown that they are the cause of homosexuality any more than you've shown that smoking causes cancer. To be able to do that, you've got to show that there's a mechanism in place.
Yes.
That the gene actually brings about the behaviour or the tobacco actually brings about the cancer. And it's explaining that mechanism. I don't see how you can avoid doing that in proper science, and to do that you've got to be a realist. Now, your account of realism, essentialism, is very attractive, and I'm myself very fond of that, but I wasn't going to let on to that at the beginning of the day. But I'm not sure whether that's a summary of what we've been talking about, but where we've got to is really a clash between the realists on the one hand and the instrumentalists on the other hand. And it came out of this dispute between Popper and Kuhn, which really left philosophy of science in a dilemma. It looked as if we were drifting into some sort of social constructionism or relativism.
This is about fictional entities. You're reading something like Robinson Crusoe as a reference to a tree, which clearly is not a real tree, because you're reading a work of fiction. And does it matter for your general scheme of things and your essences that may or may not have an essence, as you quoted?
I'm not sure how that connects with what I was. I mean, I might be inclined to say that when Defoe said, well, there was a tree on the island, he meant a real tree.
And the fact that it is
I want you to believe that there was a real tree on this island. You can't follow the story if you don't believe there was a tree on this island, it was a real tree.
The mere fact that it's fictional doesn't matter, it is included in your general class of trees, includes fictional trees.
Well, there are different levels. I mean, there's the question. I'm interested in the question, what is a tree? What is a tree is something like the account of I gave of what a horse is, but a tree doesn't have an essence because trees change, they're the things that most spectacularly change. So, but they're built on little essential building blocks, cells and chemicals and things like that, are very stable essences, and then there's a particular combination that's a tree, and it gives rise to a certain thing. There are certain characteristics that trees all have, they all have sort of trunks and stuff like that, and leaves. And so you end up with these pretty essential properties for a tree, but you might get a freaky tree that does something a bit different. But you've got a notion of a tree, but the notion of what a tree is built up on this hierarchy of smaller and smaller things where that really, really fits. And that's my picture of a tree. That's not addressing the Robinson Crusoe question.
No, all I'm saying is whether it extends, whether fictional trees extend to your general class of trees.
Well, you could have two things. Either when he said there's a tree on the island, he meant something that will fit the following set of descriptions, or something that had the essence. If you switch to water, the famous example in philosophy, he says there's some water on the island. Well, he either meant something that falls out of the clouds and is wet and runs around the rivers, or he meant there was some H2O. And presumably this is where Putnam comes in. He says, well, he meant there was some H2O on this island. He didn't know it was H2O, but that's what he meant there. So that's what the essentialist is going to say. He's going to say, he was saying there's some H2O. He hadn't got the scientists to find to tell him what it was he was referring to.
Are you driving at what's in our mind as opposed to what is out in the real world?
No, the question was, much as anything else is clearly what is about methods, price. Saying you're trying to sell a method, might be called essentialism, right? And all I'm asking is how much it covers, because we all hear this description, but how something gets a name, the naming of things. And all I'm saying is, does it include fiction? That's what I'm saying.
Can we just let another question come in?
You would, an essentialist wouldn't include fictional object in its ontology, would it? Because fiction is a totally different discourse.
Yes, but
it rather goes the other way around, doesn't it? I mean, you can't have a fictional something unless you have a real something.
Absolutely.
So I, I'm sure that it's
I mean, that fictional thing is a mental image of a real thing.
Yes.
So the question is, does the real thing have this?
It might be a big more does, than mental
image.
So
yeah.
It's not that, would he extend it to, or would, I can't remember which way around you put it, but it is, once you've got the real thing, you can have the fictional.
Yeah.
Can I ask, what an essentialist would say about, for example, mental illness. Let's take schizophrenia. Suppose we were to identify mental illness in the medieval times. What you're pointing at there, you believe the essence of that mental illness is possession by a demon. Now, we have the same symptoms over the centuries, but we give it a different essence. Now we don't give it demons, we call it biochemical imbalances. So how does an essentialist deal with a case like that where the essence itself seems to be changing?
No, the essence isn't changing. That isn't conventional. That's scientists. The whole point is that scientists are trying to find out what the essence actually is. We think it's chemical imbalances. We're not going to be conclusive. There's nothing, you know, essentialists don't have to aren't going around saying, well, we've cracked it. We know the truth about everything. You know, this is, you know, science at the moment seems to think that the essence is so and so. We're open to a new theory. You know.
But the original baptism was of these demons.
Yeah.
That's what they baptized.
No, it wasn't. It was the baptism of a particular person who wasn't feeling well. That person was baptized as having this thing, and then the demons were the explanation.
And you ask the priest who did the baptizing, he'll say, that's the demons I baptized.
The scientist that he's dead.
He didn't meet the demon. He never met the demon. He met someone who was behaving exactly like modern mental patients.
Sorry, Brian, I think I need to just keep controlling, so I'll put you on the list. The animal's next on the list.
Okay. I have serious worries about all this metaphysics creeping in. Because it seems to me that humans are doing various jobs. They're both individual and kind essences. And I understand criteria for identification of individual things. And I understand criteria for classification of things. And I can see how the criteria for classification link with explanations of property behavior, propensities, which again are different from pure classification, involve some sort of explanation theory. But what does it add to any of these activities to call them the identification of essences? It's Voltaire and his Dormitiva, whatever it was.
I think classification of living things is a good example of what we're talking about, because traditional classification, I think, starts with Aristotle, and it's always done on very superficial features. But where the advance of the study of zoology and so on has been gradual reclassification and redrawing of the tree diagrams, and now we're redrawing them very much on the basis of DNA. And I think that supports exactly what I'm saying, that this is cutting nature at the joints. But if you go for the superficial descriptions, you get a bogus family tree. But when you get to the essence of the thing, you start to get the family tree right.
I'm happy with all the classification activity on an empirical basis. You want to invoke this thing called discovery, or the essences, which is somehow separate from the business of classifying. Because it's there already, and that seems to be
well, cutting nature of the joints is the aim, and this is a scientific. This isn't an a priori activity. This is a scientific research program to find where the joints are. And so you've got to get down to the mechanisms to find out what makes all these things tick, in order to get the classification. I've conceded that there's a load of metaphysics in sort of possibilities and so on, but I don't see what else I'm going wrong. I mean, if you allow that there are particular things which have individual essences, and you admit that there are kind essences which are shared, you know, like we have a kind essence with horses because we're both mammals, and so, and you have to dig deep into our biology. Now, you know, initially we just said, well, they have live young or all the rest of it. The modern view is you're going to have to dig deeper and say, well, there's this, you know, in the genome, you know, there's these chunks here, they're the same, that's why we're related to horses. And at that point, you've clinched it, you know.
To carry on with Alan's word metaphysics, I think there is a deep metaphysical assumption in conceptualism, and that is, well, it simply is a metaphysical assumption that you keep saying about being able to carve nature at the joints, and that carving is unique.
The assumption is that there are joints to be discovered.
Yes, and that there is only one unique set of joints that is the actual, and that is a metaphysical assumption.
Some joints are very clear and some are a bit vague.
But what I'm trying to get you to see is that is a metaphysical assumption. It may be correct in my opinion.
Everybody's got a metaphysics, and it's not wicked to have a metaphysics.
Well, it's interesting that Trevor contrasted sort of instrumentalism with essentialism, because I think it's the metaphysical overtones of essentialism.
If you hate metaphysics, it sounds to me as if you've totally absorbed it epistemology, and you're not asking, your experience is your evidence, and you're not asking what this evidence of.
Nobody can do without metaphysics altogether, but one can question that particular
metaphysics. I'm trying to offer physics, not metaphysics.
But there is a deep metaphysical assumption under your physics, and that metaphysical assumption, as Marianne said, is that the assumption that you can carve nature by the joints, and that carving is absolutely unique and not relative to us and our cultural background and so on.
I said it's absolutely unique. There are some very distinct joints. There are four people sitting there. There aren't 5.5 people or 6.3 people, there are 4 people sitting here, and that's a sort of pretty obvious joint to me.
Yes, but essentialism isn't about more than just the fact that there are 4 people.
Well, I'm saying that's where you start. When asking, has nature got any joints?
Yeah.
I'm saying, well, there's some obvious joints here, and then there's some lesser, there's a joint, I've got an elbow, and that's a joint, and you're going to tell me I haven't got an elbow, and those are obvious joints. And then it gets really, where does an electron stop, Well, I don't know.
For example, in the example that I concentrated on between the three figures of Aristotle, Newton and Einstein, the carving in the joints that each of those three people would have done would have been different. So it's changed, the story we're told changes.
Well, you can be wrong. You can't just say it's all completely conventional simply because some people were wrong.
You have a point. If you want to come in with yours now.
Well, I think incorporation of stuff we said, as it were, reveals the mechanism. It seems to me there's an asymmetry between realism and instrumentalism, which you seem to stand on. In that, if you look at realism not as a philosophical theory, but as a scientific theory, which is the reason for it, then instrumentalism can subsume it. Instrumentalism would look at realism as instrumental. Whereas you can't do that the other way around. Is that true?
Well, I think at a theoretical level, that's true, but I don't think that determines which one's the correct way of looking at science.
It takes the correct desire to be
correct. Yeah. I can see what you mean, but what an instrumentalist can say is that realism works and it gives us the right predictions and so on, and therefore. But that's, as it were, a meta instrumentalism. That's not claiming that instrumentalism is the right science approach for science. You're saying that realism is the right approach for science. And it was taking a bit of a meta view of that, which is quite interesting. This time I accept that.
Good. Question just over here.
Yes, generally we explain the difference between the religious method and the scientific method. The scientific method is you look at what is the facts before you decide what you want to do. The religious method, of course, is to go from wouldn't it be nice if to an ought. And so that all the soft sciences are only soft for the simple reason that they have a scientific, a religious component to them. Herbert Spencer in 1850 proved quite conclusively, I think, that most of the questions that have this wouldn't it be nice if, he explained them all and showed them to be either true or false. So that this is a very false, this is what has created the soft scientists, which can he made hard scientists in his day. So the future of science is going to be making soft sciences hard sciences, because that will revolutionise a lot of the sociology.
Can I take up something here? Because it's one of the problems I have with essentialism and so forth. But the idea that possibilities, causal powers, are if-then things. This will cause that if it's given the right circumstances. And this means that you've got to include in your ontology not what is, but what might be if. And that is not exactly what you're talking about, but it brings in an element of ontology which I find most disquieting. You admitted that it was a problem. I wonder if you'd like to.
Well, it's not a problem that bothers me, but I. It bothers me a problem that bother other people, so I sort of. I mean, powers, I think, is the word. You know, that some certain things have certain power. A magnet has a power to pick up a piece of metal. There are no pieces of the metal around, and there never will be, so it's never going to do it. You know, but there's a distinct possibility if. Piece of metal comes there, it'll go boing, you know, and that's just, and that's, I'm not being crazy with my ontology, I'm trying to explain to you what a magnet is, and so all I'm saying is, the point is it's an active power, you see, and I think your question is premised on a rather passive notion of stuff, and then you've got all this metaphysics bringing in the notion, you know, this extra thing, but what I'm saying is this magnet's got an active power which will attract bits of metal. So obviously if you've got bits of metal here, it'll do it. I haven't added anything magic to the ontology and what's in the room. I'm just trying to tell you, you know, that's the physics of this thing.
It's just you're including these possibilities in ontology. I would accept that the magnet has the properties, the things in it that it does, the pieces of iron, the atoms arranged in certain lines and so forth. They're all there. But they're all
you can't make a magnet on Wednesday and add the magnet on Thursday.
All the properties are there from the start. Yeah. But the possibility that it will pick up iron is not there now. That occurs when it occurs. It's not part of its ontology.
Well, how are you going to explain the fact that something can have an unrealised power? It can have a power that it never actually achieved. I could have been a great actor, but no one ever gave me a part. So I got this unrealised power, and it always will be. You know? but that's saying something about me.
Well, this is the reductionist in me. I'd say that has to reduce to a set of properties that you actually possess.
Yes, but what I'm saying is, quite, but they're active properties. And so if you stick me on stage, I leap into life and do my thing, because I've got these active powers. I'm just trying to describe the active powers. I'm not trying to modify ontology in silly ways.
But I don't think the possibility of you acting is part of your ontology.
Well, how are you going to say that I've got the possibility to be a great actor if you don't mean...
Because what you have got, when put in the right circumstances, does what it does.
I'm just conscious now we've got to 3:30. There are several questions.